Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It says it right there in Article 1, Section 2 of the United States Constitution. Every 10 years, the government is directed to make a count, an actual enumeration, of people and where they live in the United States. Now, the Constitution doesn't say much more than that, but of course, the modern U.S. Census does ask other questions as well. And for the 2020 Census, one particular question is facing immense legal and political scrutiny. The government wants to know, quote, is this person a citizen of the United States? Well, several states and groups are challenging the legality of that question and how it got onto the 2020 census. Tomorrow, the United States Supreme Court hears the case. So this hour on Point, the census and the citizenship question. And you can join us. Would you answer a question about your citizenship status on the 2020 census form? What is at stake here? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, we'll begin today in Washington with Hanzi Lo Wang, national correspondent covering the census 2020 for NPR. Hanzi, it's good to have you on Point.
Thank you for having me, Meghna.
So first of all, just start off with a little primer here about how this case got to the Supreme Court, or how the Supreme Court justices will be hearing it tomorrow. Where did the concern begin about the citizenship question on the 2020 census?
Well, the citizenship question first became public December of 2017. That's when ProPublica published a draft request from the Justice Department, a letter showing that the Justice Department was formally asking the Census Bureau to add a citizenship question to the 2020 census. This is a question that asks, is this person a citizen of the United States? And the Justice Department in this letter wrote that it wanted this question in order to have more detailed citizenship data in order to enforce part of the Voting Rights Act, specifically Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which has provisions to prevent discrimination of language and racial minorities. And Census Bureau currently does collect citizenship data through what's known as American Community Survey, and that data has been used to enforce part of the Voting Rights Act for years. And so this would be a new request. And it was an unusual request if you were to ask voting rights advocates. And when they heard about this, they were very confused because they don't believe there is a data problem, that there is adequate citizenship data, they say, in order to enforce the Voting Rights Act. And the greater concern is that the Census Bureau for years has considered this question, a question about U.S. citizenship status, a sensitive question. And in fact, it's produced research in the recent months that suggests that it's likely asking this question in this current political climate of increased immigration enforcement and growing anti-immigrant rhetoric, that this question will discourage households with non-citizens. And it's households with non-citizens, so those households could include citizens as well. And that ultimately, the concern here is that will harm the government's ability to conduct a headcount that's required by the Constitution of every person right. living in the country, regardless of citizenship or immigration status.
So that it could produce an undercount, which then the census is used not just for the apportionment of House districts, but for so many other aspects of how the federal government operates and makes decisions. But Hanzi, you mentioned about the Voting Rights Act, that the government said that has said that it, in order to protect the Voting Rights Act, it wants to be able to know, add the citizenship question to the census. But as the case against this question has been making its way through the court system to the Supreme Court, I mean, you've been reporting how it's been revealed that that was not the original intention of the Trump administration, right? When they put the question on the 2020 census.
Right. The Trump administration has maintained that this is about the Voting Rights Act. However, three federal judges at U.S. District Courts in New York and California, as well as Maryland, have ruled that to be what one judge called a sham justification. And it's unclear exactly what the Trump administration's real motive would be if it's not the Voting Rights Act. However, if you were to look through the documents, the internal emails and memos released as part of these lawsuits that more than 24 states and cities, as well as other groups, have filed around around the country, forcing the Trump administration to release documents to justify their decision to add this question. If you look at those documents, one term that keeps on coming up is apportionment. And this is the process in which the census numbers, the population counts are used to determine how many congressional seats each state gets after each census. And there were questions asked within the Trump administration, specifically by Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, who oversees the Census Bureau and has ultimate authority over the census as delegated by Congress. Secretary Ross was asking whether or not undocumented immigrants were included in census numbers, specifically for apportionment. And so this was certainly a theme, and as well as there were another interesting email from former Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach, who was a former vice chair of President Trump's now defunct Commission on Voter Fraud. Chris Kobach, he had emailed in conversations with Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross. They were connected by former White House Chief Strategist Steve Bannon. And Kobach suggested in an email a citizenship question, wording for one that went further and actually included responses to collect not just citizenship status information of a person, but also their immigration status. And Chris Kobach raised in this email concerns that undocumented immigrants are included in apportionment numbers, that he felt that that was a problem.
So, we'll talk in more detail throughout the rest of the show about sort of what's at stake here on either side of whether or not this question ends up on the census. But Hanzi, how did it get to the Supreme Court so quickly? And what does it signal to you that the justices agreed to hear this case?
Everything is sped up because there are very tight deadlines. The 2020 census is less than a year away. It officially starts in January 2020 in remote Alaska, in Tuksuk Bay, Alaska. It usually starts in the most rural parts of Alaska and then officially rolls out to most households, can start participating around mid-March of next year. So the time is ticking away, and by July, that's when the Census Bureau says it has to start printing paper forms for the 2020 census, and it needs to know by July 1st, the Census Bureau says, whether or not a citizenship question will be on the census or not. And as I've said, three federal judges have issued rulings blocking the addition of a citizenship question. And after that first ruling by a judge in New York, the Trump administration started its appeal and appealed it to the appellate court, to the circuit court level. And then it made the unusual move to, after making that move, to appeal it to the Supreme Court and ask the Supreme Court to essentially bypass the circuit court level and not wait for a circuit court to review the New York judge's ruling and to step in. And that's what the Supreme Court is doing right now, stepping in before the circuit court, the second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the New York courts has ruled anything. And is going to review the New York judge's ruling, as well as consider this question of whether or not adding this question was constitutional. And that's a question that judges in California and Maryland have since ruled that they believe it's unconstitutional.
Well, Hanzi Lo Wong, national correspondent for NPR, with us from Washington. Stand by for just a second, Hanzi, because I want to welcome into the conversation Mithun Mansinghani. He's the Solicitor General for the state of Oklahoma and helped file an amicus brief in support of the Department of Commerce and the citizenship question in the case that's going to appear before the Supreme Court tomorrow. And he joins us from Oklahoma City. Mithun Mansinghani, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Magna.
So first of all, let me ask you, I mean, as Hanzi outlined for us, a major reasoning that the Commerce Department has put forward is, for the citizenship question, is the protection or the proper protection, I'll just put it that way, for the Voting Rights Act. But I'm wondering, if a citizenship question hasn't been on the decennial census since 1950, and many administrations have found that they can get all the information they need from the American Community Survey, as Hanzi was telling us, what's so different now? Why do you need a citizenship question on the decennial census?
So it's not true that the decennial census hasn't contained a citizenship question since 1950. It contained it on the long-form census, which went to 1 in 6 households, for every census until the 2010 census. And that provided pretty good citizenship data, actually better citizenship data than what is present on the ACS, which has only been asked since 2005, so for census purposes, since the 2010 census. And the ACS data, while, you know, is usable, is not actually very, very good. And prior to this controversy, many people including some of the plaintiffs in this case, like the state of New York, recognized the flaw in ACS data because it only samples one in every 36 households asked on a rolling basis rather than at the same time as the census, which causes a significant amount of data problems that the states, like Oklahoma or like Texas, have to litigate because when we redraw our districts, because there's ambiguity, because there is controversy over what the data from the ACS means, litigants can challenge whether the district was appropriately drawn.
Right.
And now we have to engage in a debate.
Well, Mithun, can I just jump in? Because I want to actually thank you for making that clarification, that the census question has been on the long form that goes to one in six households, as you just said. I appreciate that clarification because it's important to note that. But also, as you said, that has been completely adequate for the federal government for more than 50 years. So if we already have the citizenship information, as you just pointed out, again, why do we need it on the short form census?
Well, the long form census no longer exists. That was ended in 2010. And so now we have a choice of, I guess we could have reinstated the long form with only a citizenship question or a bunch of other questions. Nobody's really suggested that we do that. Or we continue to use the difficult to use and somewhat flawed ACS sampling data, or we add it to the short form census. And 16 states wrote to the federal government supporting the citizenship question while Secretary Ross was making his decision. Generally, that fact was ignored by the lower courts, but we have written both to the Supreme Court as well as the lower courts that these states at least pushed for the inclusion of the citizenship question.
I see. Okay. And we just have about 30 seconds before I have to take a quick break here. But if indeed putting the citizenship question into the 2020 census may result in a not insignificant undercount, isn't it undermining the entire purpose of the census to begin with? Because we won't get a proper enumeration of folks living in the United States?
Ultimately, there's not a lot of great data showing that it will definitely cause a significant undercount. Unfortunately, the reality is that every census has included an undercount, including the 2010 census, which disproportionately undercounted Hispanics. But the empirical data that was presented to the secretary was not did not include reliable information that a significant undercount would happen.
Well, Mithun Mansinghani and Hanzi Lo Wong, hang on here for just a second. We are talking about the census and the citizenship question, and we'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the 2020 census and the citizenship question. The United States Supreme Court tomorrow hears arguments over the legality or the constitutionality, I should say, of including a citizenship question in the upcoming census of the United States. I'm joined today by Hanzi Lo Wong. He's NPR's national correspondent. He's been focusing on the 2020 census. Mithun Mansinghani also joins us. He's Solicitor General for the state of Oklahoma, and he helped file an amicus brief in support of the Department of Commerce's attempts or efforts to put a citizenship question on the 2020 census. Let's listen to what Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross said as he appeared in front of the House Oversight and Reform Committee in March. And he repeatedly cited the Department of Justice and the Voting Rights Act as the reason for the citizenship question. And he said it's not because the Trump administration wants additional tools for immigration enforcement.
No one's individual data will be used for any other purpose other than the aggregations that we provide externally. So this is not a tool as such for immigration. Our job is simply to count the people, whether citizen or not.
That's the Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross in March. Mithun Mansinghani, let me just ask you a quick question here about, again, this issue of the Voting Rights Act. Because as Hansi Lo Wong was telling us at the beginning of the conversation, as this case has wound its way through the court system, through legal documents and through court filings, we see here that essentially Commerce Secretary Ross has been dissembling about using the Voting Rights Act as the justification for this question. That it wasn't even in the original thinking about why they wanted to include the citizenship question. So just respond to that. Does it seem as if it's just being used as a convenient justification for other means?
Well, I'm not going to pretend to get into this Commerce Secretary's head. I can say that the states did ask for it because of our experience with trying to use ACS data instead of census data for Voting Rights Act purposes. There are lots of times that cabinet officials will have an idea and we'll see what are the pros and cons of that idea. The Justice Department told him one of the pros of that idea would be better data for Voting Rights Act enforcement. And the Secretary of Commerce was correct in what he said in the congressional testimony you just played, that census data cannot be used by federal or state law enforcement for immigration or any other purposes, that it's punishable by up to 5 years in prison if anybody at the Census Bureau reveals individual response data beyond aggregation. And the public, including hopefully the listeners of your show, should know that their census responses are totally and completely protected and will not result in any legal repercussions if they accurately respond to it.
Hansi Lo Wong, some people, we have comments coming in here online from everyone, from folks saying, doesn't bother me one bit, doesn't bother my friend with a green card. Other listeners saying, shouldn't we know how many non-citizens we have? Another comment on our website, none of this would even be an issue if Congress did what they were supposed to and passed laws fixing the broken immigration system. But on the other hand, someone named Yar says this case is a political test for the Supreme Court. It should be 9-0 against adding a question on the citizenship. Is the court willing to advertise, though? What Yar says is it's blatant partisanship. So a lot of different views there. But I'm wondering about the concern that some people have about the information or what the government might do with this information. We just heard Mithun Mansinghani saying the information is protected. But have we had cases in history where the United States government did use citizenship information to act against residents in the country?
I don't know what any cases of using citizenship information, but certainly one concern that people have brought up, those who are concerned about the confidentiality of census information, is the use of census information about Japanese Americans during World War II. Census information, disaggregated census information, or rather aggregated census information, information that did not identify individuals, was used in order to pinpoint exactly where there were concentrations of Japanese populations of Japanese descent along the West Coast in order to round up U.S. citizens of Japanese descent and put them in incarceration camps during World War II. And there also was another case not related to the incarceration camps in the Washington, D.C. area, where census information identifying individuals with names tied to people of Japanese descent, that was released by the Census Bureau to other agencies in the federal government in order to conduct investigation into threats against an official. This is a concern that the public has to trust that the federal government will uphold the law. And during World War II, there were laws that were passed that allow these exceptions to be made under the War Powers Resolution. To be clear, the Census Bureau can release information identifying individuals 72 years after the information is collected. Mm. And that's how many folks who do genealogy and research their family history, that's how they can actually see the census records, identifying people's names, where they lived, who their neighbors were. That's how that's possible. So 72 years, which originally put in place because that was assumed to be a person's lifetime. But there are concerns about whether or not the public can trust this administration. And there have been emails that I've uncovered as part of these lawsuits. One discussion amongst Justice Department officials raising the issue of the possibility of renewed debate over whether or not any part of the Patriot Act could force the Commerce Department to release information identifying individuals in terms of for law enforcement activity.
Well, Hansi Lo Wong and Mithun Mansinghani, just hang on here for a second because I want to introduce Thomas Sines into the conversation. He joins us from Los Angeles. He's president of the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, which filed federal lawsuits against the census question. Thomas Sines, welcome to you.
Thank you, Megan.
So let me just ask you, first of all, Mithun Mansinghani pointed out to us that we don't have the long form census questionnaire anymore. We only have the short form, but there was a census question on the long form questionnaire for decades. It went to 1 in 6 households. So what's the concern now to put it on the short form census?
Well, the concern is that this would require 100% of households to answer the question, as opposed to sample data that was obtained previously through the long form, but as a nation, we abandoned the long form in favor of the American Community Survey, which, as you know, is a yearly survey of a sample of Americans. It goes into greater detail, not just on citizenship, but on many other attributes of a household. And that sample data has proven very useful, indeed, all that's necessary for those more detailed areas of inquiry. No one is suggesting we return to the long form because, frankly, other than the politicized question here, folks have concluded that the ACS sample data is as useful as the sample data that was previously obtained through the long form.
Okay, so then take us to your bottom line here. What do you think is really at stake if the question appears on the 2020 census?
If the question appears and it triggers a significant undercount larger than we usually see, we will have an inaccurate picture of our country. We will have skewed representation away from those states that have larger populations that did not answer the question or did not submit a form even. And we will have a failure to appreciate where we should be investing resources. For example, if those who don't respond skew in a particular way, older or younger, more likely older in this case, then we'll have an inaccurate picture of the kind of services that we need to provide everywhere in the country to those who are over a certain age, for example.
But you heard Mithun Mansinghani say a couple of minutes ago that he believes there wasn't adequate evidence that it would produce an undercount.
That's because they've never tested the question. The Census Bureau didn't contemplate including a citizenship question on the 2020 census until a year ago when they were basically ordered to do so by Secretary Wilbur Ross. Ordinarily, the Bureau is very deliberative and tests every question multiple times to see what is the response rate, to see how folks are responding to the specific wording of each question. In this case, they had no opportunity to do that because it was a political decision made at the very last moment entirely to trigger a significant undercount rather than having any relationship to the kind of data integrity that the Bureau usually achieves through studying questions before they are even considered for the questionnaire.
I see. So we'll get back to that in a second. But we have some really interesting questions coming in online from our listeners. Sam Girardi is asking us on Facebook this basic question. Sam says, shouldn't we know how many non-citizens we have? And what's your response to Sam?
My response is we already have a measure of how many non-citizens we have through the sample data of the ACS and also through the Department of Homeland Security's own files about those who have an open case. And that includes not just lawful permanent residents, but those who are in the process of being adjudicated. So we have that data available to us. We also know where those folks live, again, from the ACS and from the DHS files. Beyond that, the problem is we're unlikely to get accurate data with the inclusion of the citizenship question on the census form in 2020. Famously, former Attorney General Jeff Sessions, when this issue raised controversy, said folks could just skip the question. Well, it turns out, as with so much of what Jeff Sessions ever said, that's legally inaccurate. You are required to fill out the census. But his saying it already suggested to many folks that they simply skip the question. Or if folks don't fill out the form because of fears triggered by the citizenship question, then we're likely to get data that's garbage from the citizenship question. And that means any desire to obtain accurate figures about the number of non-citizens in the country will be lost. We won't get accurate data from this questionnaire.
Mithun Mansinghani, would you like to respond to what Thomas Saenz is saying?
Sure. The idea that the citizenship question is untested is not true because it's been asked on the ACS. Now, if you say that's insufficient testing for a good question, well, then the current data that we're getting from the ACS is also insufficient. The reality of the matter is that we have, as he mentioned, administrative records through the Social Security Administration, through the Immigration Administration, that can help fill in gaps in the citizenship data. And the census has robust follow-up procedures for people who choose to not initially respond to the census or respond to a specific question. That has been very effective in the past in obviating the problems caused by initial non-response.
Hanzi Lo Wong, help us out here, because I'm hearing a lot of things about the ACS is good for certain things, it's not good for other things. The question has been tested because it's been on the ACS, but it hasn't been tested because it's not been on the short form. I mean, fact check this for us. Is there a difference between having the citizenship question on the short form questionnaire versus the ACS?
Yes. There is, I think the basic understanding is a survey is a very delicate, sensitive instrument. Changing in words, changing in how, where a question appears, the ordering of the questions, these are all very in-the-weeds decisions that the Census Bureau labors over and deliberates over in order to produce a tool that will collect the most accurate information. And so testing of a citizenship question and its use of it on the American Community Survey helps the Census Bureau figure out what may be the response to a 2020 census citizenship question, but it is not the usual process for the Census Bureau in order to consider a full testing of a new census question. And I think another context to keep in mind here is that the Census Bureau recommended to Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, after it received this Justice Department request for more detailed citizenship data, it recommended not adding a citizenship question, but instead to collect these existing government records from Department of Homeland Security, from the State Department, from Social Security Administration, to use those records and compiling it together. And the Census Bureau says that that data would be more accurate, less expensive than adding a citizenship question onto the 2020 census, because responses that people are reporting themselves about their citizenship data, the Census Bureau has found that to be not accurate information.
Well, let's go to our callers quickly if we can before we run out of time. Patrick is calling from Greenville, Tennessee. Patrick, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm all for getting the citizenship question on the census to make it more complete. However, the citizenship question should be in three parts, in my opinion. One, U.S.-born, naturalized, and illegal. And that's about it. I'm a taxpayer, and I'd like to see it on the census.
Patrick, thank you for your call. Thomas Saenz, how would you respond to Patrick's desire to see the question on the census?
Well, again, I think we should all understand that we don't need the question to be asked of 100% of households, especially if it's likely to trigger a significant undercount, as I think all of the experts have opined that it will. It's important to remember that it's households that fill out a census form. So what we're likely to see is a household may respond but leave out certain members of the household. And that's where the Bureau is most unable to follow up. So we've heard reference to the non-response follow-up that the Bureau engages in, but it engages in that follow-up when it knows a household exists and it's not received a form from that household. It has no way of knowing whether it should follow up if a household reports but leaves out some members of the household. In the past, we've seen that primarily with infants and young children, preschool-age children. For whatever reason, households leave out the youngest members. In this case, the citizenship question may well trigger leaving folks out of the household in the other direction. It may be older folks who have citizenship issues, older folks who are more afraid of revealing their citizenship status. And so those folks will be left out of households, and the Bureau won't know to follow up. That's why we're likely to get garbage data when you do a 100% survey on a question like this. So a desire to get complete data doesn't really support adding the question. In fact, it does just the opposite. It means that we will get less complete responses across the board.
Mithun Mansinghani, we've just got about under a minute to go. Do you want to respond to that?
Sure. Using administrative data can be helpful, and the Secretary has decided to use a combination of the administrative records we have in federal agencies plus a citizenship question to come up with citizenship data. And the combination of those two will actually provide better overall data than what we have via the ACS, because administrative records are missing about probably around 30 million people. And so the citizenship question can be used to fill in those gaps. The Census Bureau's chief scientist testified at the trial in this case. There's no credible quantitative evidence that the addition of a citizenship question will affect the accuracy of the count. And if you look at the underlying data that was relied upon by Census Bureau staff, they engaged in a lot of unwarranted assumptions. Looking at some of the data they presented, we've determined that an undercount may be as low as 0.001% of the population.
All right. Well, obviously, there's a lot of disagreement over a number of administrative issues around, including this question on the census. But at the heart of it, it's a political question as well. We'll probably come back to it after the Supreme Court hears the case tomorrow. So I just want to say thank you to Mithun Mansinghani, to Thomas Sines, and to Hansi Lo Wong as well for helping us guide us through how we got here to the Supreme Court case, which will happen tomorrow. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's switch gears now and talk about next steps following last week's release of a redacted version of the Mueller report. We've heard a variety of reactions from members of Congress, with some Democrats prevaricating over the impeachment question. The president himself tweeted about it this weekend and also this morning in a tweet, claiming in part, quote, "Only high crimes and misdemeanors can lead to impeachment. There were no crimes by me," end quote. But beyond the immediate concerns surrounding the Trump administration, there's also this question. What message is Congress sending to Russia? What happens in 2020 or 2024 or every other future election if Congress decides to do nothing at all? Well, you can join the conversation. What are you asking your representatives to do or not do? And how do you think this will all play out in future elections? And we're going to start in Washington with Yamiche Alcindor, White House correspondent for PBS News. Yamiche, it's great to have you back on Point.
Thanks for having me.
So I do want to actually just get caught up with you over what we heard this weekend. So first of all, what has been the response from the White House over the weekend following the release of the Mueller report?
Well, the president has really doubled down on this idea that there was no collusion, no obstruction. He's claiming still that he was totally vindicated. He has gotten angrier at the Mueller team by saying that this was a crazy report. He's also fixated on former White House counsel Don McGahn, basically saying that he was someone who double-crossed him and betrayed him. Then you have Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal lawyer. He was on several Sunday shows, and he said that there was really nothing wrong with taking information from Russia and that any candidate would want information, dirt on their opponent, and that people should just look at that and think that's what people would do. He said that he would advise against it. But what we're seeing now is really the president's team going on offense and saying nothing that we did was wrong and that it's pretty normal what they did, which is completely not the case.
Okay, so they're going on offense, and yet in Congress, at least in the House, from House Democrats, which is where impeachment proceedings would begin, if they do at all, well, there's no sort of—the Democrats are not acting in lockstep on this. So, I mean, where are they—what are they thinking? What have they been saying?
The Democrats are really in a tough position, and in particular, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is in a tough position. There are some people in her caucus that are now starting to say that impeachment should be done. And there are people like House Judiciary Chairman Jerry Nadler, who was on Meet the Press this weekend. And when he was asked specifically, would obstruction of justice be something that should be an impeachable offense? He said yes. So while Nancy Pelosi has been very clear on the fact that she doesn't want to go down the impeachment line, there are people in her caucus and their House committee chairs who are saying, essentially, we could possibly be wanting to impeach the president. And then you, of course, have 2020 candidates. Most of them have not talked about impeachment. But Elizabeth Warren made some big news when she came out ahead and said, you know what? I would be in favor of impeaching the president. Now, I've been talking to sources in her campaign, and they tell me that they want to say that while she did come to that conclusion of, after reading the Mueller report, that the president should be impeached, she also wants to be focused on big policy issues. Today, she's rolling out a policy on student debt. So she's trying to both talk about impeachment while also focusing on other policies, which gets at the fact that Democrats know they are in a tough position.
Right. Well, so let's hear from some other Democrats here. This is Representative Tim Ryan, Democrat of Ohio, and perhaps another presidential hopeful, explaining to CNN's Jake Tapper about why he's willing to hold off on impeachment for now.
Yeah, let the process play itself out. Let's educate the American people, too, Jake. This is a very nuanced document. Let the American people really see what's going on here. It paints a terrible picture of the president's interactions. The blatant lying that happens in directing people to lie to the public, to lie to lawyers, to lie to the Congress. I mean, it's very detailed. The American people, through this process, will get up to speed with how this administration has been behaving.
That's Congressman Tim Ryan, Democrat of Ohio. Yamiche, hang on here for just a second, because I want to bring in Tom Nichols into the conversation. He joins us via Skype from Newport, Rhode Island, and he's a professor at the U.S. Naval War College, specializing in Russian affairs and national security. Tom Nichols, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so Tom Nichols, if you are Vladimir Putin, or if you're anyone in the Russian intelligence establishment, and you hear Congressman Tim Ryan, what are you thinking right now?
Well, first, I should say I don't represent the views of the government here. I think, you know, Putin is, his answer is mission accomplished. There is no right answer at this point. No matter what we do, in a sense, Putin's already gotten what he wanted, which is maximum chaos. I mean, in some ways, an impeachment would almost be the cherry on the sundae, would paralyze the U.S. government. It would fail, obviously, because of the intransigence of the Republicans in the Senate. I think there are two things that Putin wouldn't want to hear. One is that the Democrats are going to have massive investigations that would expose his operations and reveal a lot of Russian secrets. And also, and this would require a directive from the commander in chief, so this isn't going to happen either, also some kind of indication that we were going to take the fight right back to the Russians and make them pay some kind of price for this. But, you know, solving this as a political problem in America by no matter how we go about it, other than, I would say, through the electoral process, is going to be something Putin's probably going to be happy to see. Because, again, the more partisanship, the more stress and paralysis in the system, the happier he is.
Okay, but so what about these the massive investigations that you're talking about that Congress could pursue? They are several House committees are pursuing further investigations. I mean, what more could they look for that Robert Mueller didn't already unearth?
Well, Robert Mueller was asked a very specific question: was there a crime committed? Was there cooperation in a very specific definition of cooperation? And with Attorney General Barr, we saw that narrowed even more tightly in a very specific way related to a specific event, the 2016 election. Congress can start looking at all kinds of things, including 30 years of the relationship between the president and the Russians, financial links. The Intelligence Committee can start looking into Putin himself and his culpability. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things that Congress can do that are much, much broader than what Robert Mueller did. I think one danger here is if Congress decides that the only focus of those, I mean, again, you can chew gum and walk at the same time, but if Congress decides the only focus of those investigations is whether the president is impeachable, there's other stuff they can miss. I think they can do both of those things at the same time.
Okay, so Yamiche Alcindor, help us then get a clearer understanding about at this point in time, where is Congress focusing? It's got numerous investigations going on.
Well, I think the message from Capitol Hill is that they can walk and chew gum at the same time. So if you talk to some of the people who are focused on or interested in impeaching the president, they will tell you they can both be looking at the president's finances, looking at his tax returns, possibly looking at impeachment. And then they can also be looking at Russia and the activities that they did. But I think that one of the things that we're seeing here when in the political realm is that people like Tim Ryan are also saying, well, the American people are going to read this report. Most people are not going to read the 448 pages of this report. Most voters aren't going to do that. What they are going to do is hear people talk about this, and they're going to – and the president in some ways has benefited from the last 2 years of reporting where we knew a lot of the things that were in the Mueller report, but it was a slow dribble. We knew about him wanting to fire the special counsel. We knew about Don McGahn saying that he was going to quit because he didn't want to carry through that. There was all this real-time reporting that benefited the president because now there was this expectation that the president in some ways isn't always truthful, and that's putting it lightly, and that his staff at times does ignore him to try to save him from his own worst instincts. So now you have a 2020 campaign where Democrats are wondering, do we make the same point that President Trump isn't presidential, that he doesn't make good decisions? That's what Hillary Clinton's argument was, and she lost. So they're also looking at whether or not they should just pivot and go more broader and look at policy.
Well, so Tom Nichols, let me ask you, I heard you say a little earlier that an impeachment proceeding would be to Vladimir Putin's liking because it would further paralyze the American political system. But, I mean, isn't a counterargument to that that it's not necessarily paralysis, but the functioning of the political system? If a special counsel essentially provides what to many people looks like the roadmap for impeachment proceedings, that to do nothing or to not follow that roadmap to whatever conclusion it might provide is essentially a dereliction of duty of Congress, that Congress wouldn't be doing its job as a co-equal branch of government.
Sure, but those are two separate arguments, Magna. One is, you know, does Congress have an obligation here? And did Robert Mueller leave breadcrumbs that, you know, or a roadmap or whatever metaphor we want to use here? That's a perfectly legitimate argument, and it may well be that Congress, especially, I think Yamiche is absolutely right, the public isn't going to read this report, but congressmen have to, and if it leads them to the conclusion that the president has committed some really seriously impeachable offenses, then that's as you say, the functioning of the system. But if you ask me how does it look from Moscow, that's a different question, especially because the outcome of an impeachment is preordained. And that is, you know, when you say wherever it leads, we have to be realistic about this. It's only going to lead one place. It's going to lead through, brutal trial that will end in acquittal because the Republicans are the Republicans, and there is not going to be any swing. And I think that again, I want to go back to Yamiche's point about the framing of this. The framing of this was really successful by the Trump administration, not just by the reporters, but also by people like Rudy Giuliani, who sounded like they were talking crazy for 2 years. When in fact what they were doing was putting as much of the craziness out in public up front to get people used to it.
Yes,
Congress may well have a duty to do this, but the Russians are going to enjoy it anyway, no matter how we go down that road.
Well, Tom and Yamiche, since both of you mentioned Rudy Giuliani, let's just play a moment here from Giuliani's appearance this weekend on CNN with Jake Tapper. And of course, Giuliani as the president's attorney. Here's what he said about the aspects of the Mueller report that said that perhaps the Trump campaign, that the Trump campaign accepted information fed to them by the Russians.
There's nothing wrong with taking information from Russians.
There's nothing wrong with taking
information. Depends on where it came from. It depends on where it came from. You're assuming that the giving of information is a campaign contribution. You read the report carefully. Mm-hmm. The report says we can't conclude that because the law is pretty much against that. Do you people get information from this person, that person?
So you would have accepted information from Russians against a client, against a candidate if you were running in the presidential election?
I probably wouldn't.
That's Rudy Giuliani on CNN this weekend. Tom Nichols, I'm just going to come out and say this. You are sounding very reasoned right now, and I appreciate that. But on Twitter, you're a little more forceful about what the Mueller report has revealed and its implications, especially volume one of the report. Not so much, we're not even talking about volume two and the, you know, what the report alleges the president has done. So I'm a little confused here with what
you're saying. It's a nightmare. I mean, as I said, on Twitter, it's volume one is a living nightmare. To go through it, you know, is ghastly. But if you're asking me the question about impeachment, that's a separate question. You know, impeachment, the Russians, again, looking at if I'm going to put on my kind of Russia hat and say, if I were Vladimir Putin, how would I regard impeachment, especially if I know how it's going to come out? That's a different question. With that said, volume one is horrendous. And it's as I wrote in USA Today recently, it's a dereliction of duty that the president's not responding to it. And what Rudy Giuliani just said is it's beyond appalling. That it is post, you know, this is just post report. Spin saying, well, you know, everyone would do it. There was a great comment recently by John Dickerson of CBS who said you'd have to change planes to cover the distance from where Giuliani and the Trump team started to get to where they are now. They started with there was nothing happened. We didn't talk to anybody. That would have been wrong all the way up to we can take information from anybody as long as it wasn't a handshake and a quid pro quo for foreign policy. And I mean, that's horrifying. Mm. And it's horrifying for Giuliani, who was a prosecutor, who would have just totally brushed aside an argument like that when he was a prosecutor. Now, you know, ending his career with this kind of ignominious rationalization.
Yeah. Well, so, Tom, let me ask you, though, before we run out of time here. What do you think the implications are for every future American election, though, given what we already know and what Robert Mueller has further illuminated?
Well, I think after what Rudy said, the Russians and others will keep trying to attack our elections. And the only thing that they're going to hear, as I said, you know, a few minutes ago, the only thing that they're going to hear that's really going to get them concerned is we see this, we are going to respond to it, and we're going to do things that not only are going to harden us against your attacks, but we're going to do some things in return that you're not going to like. And that requires a decision by the national leadership to do it. And right now, we just don't have this. So pretty much everything at this point is a net win for the Russians, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, Yamiche Alcindor, we've just got a minute left here to go. How do you read sort of we started this conversation by you telling us how the White House has been responding, how the president has been responding. I mean, are they responding from a point of confidence that impeachment proceedings may not eventually unfold?
I think the president is feeling like the impeachment will not happen because of really what Tom said, which is this idea that it's going to fail and that it's going to take up all the oxygen in Washington while Democrats want to have some sort of platform to show to the American people to make their case that they have better ideas than Donald Trump, not just that they're not Donald Trump. So I think, and the president likes the idea of talking about impeachment because his voters get more excited to vote for him when they talk about impeachment.
Well, Yamiche Alcindor, White House correspondent for PBS News Hour. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Tom Nichols, professor at the U.S. Naval War College specializing in Russian affairs and national security. Tom, it was great to have you. Thank you so much.
Great to be with you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.